Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
Being a father now and watching it through your child's eyes, are they feeling the same thing I felt when I was a kid? Terrified at the queen, awed by the glittering diamonds in the mine, smiled at the songs. I'm wishing for the one I love. And are they going to have the same recollections of it 20 years from now? Gosh, I hope so. I can't wait to see their faces when they open at Christmas morning.
Hello and welcome to Ink and Paint Inbetweeners, our series of bonus episodes expanding on the story of the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. In these short bonus episodes, we're sharing history and stories related to the Disney animated classics that sit just outside of the films themselves and complement our main Ink and Paint episodes. In this episode, we're diving into one of the most important developments in the relationship between the Disney animated classics and their audience, Walt Disney Home Video. Since the late 1980s, an integral component of the legacy of the Disney animated features has been their presence on home video. While theatrical re-releases were consistent into the 1990s, these releases on VHS, Laserdisc, DVD, Blu-ray and 4K UHD have often been the first contact for millions of children with the Disney classics, to the extent that a VHS in a clamshell case has become an emotional family heirloom. In many ways, the persistence of these classics is a result of the home video revolution, not only making the films more accessible, but a constant presence in family homes. They could be rewatched over and over again, the tape worn down until it could barely function, and the cover left in tatters. The Walt Disney Company is infamous for their unusual home video practices, especially their moratorium process of limiting the availability of a title, and their handling of their legacy on the format has ranged from groundbreaking to Machiavellian. In this in-betweener, we're going to take a look at the origins of Walt Disney Home Video, a story of careful and strategic choices that helped build the company into the great entertainment juggernaut at the end of the 20th century. The concept of audiences being able to watch a film in the comfort of their own home is almost as old as cinema itself. The earliest discussions of home viewing date back to 1906, and in 1912, Thomas Edison and Pathé both began developing home projector systems. Due to the expense associated with manufacturing film prints, the films were more often rented from the projector manufacturers. But Edison was led by his understanding of the phonograph and had misjudged consumer demand. The practice didn't last out the decade, with both companies phasing out their home projector manufacturing by the start of the First World War. For most of the 20th century, the only opportunity to see a feature film would be in a movie theatre, and often not past its first theatrical run. There were revival cinemas and re-release schedules, but these were only for particularly popular films. The arrival of television did give these films a second life, but before the advent of home recording technology, it was only possible to watch these films as they were broadcast. In 1965, Kodak began to manufacture 8mm film for home video recording. This became a popular practice, but in order to enjoy the films, consumers also needed an 8mm projector. This offered a unique opportunity for distributing professionally made content for domestic entertainment, including material from feature films. Consumers could rent or buy 8mm or 16mm reels featuring cartoons, shorts, or highlight reels from feature films. The format couldn't support an entire feature, but audiences could enjoy scenes from the films at home, sometimes accompanied by optical soundtracks. It was still an expensive practice, so for the most part, only hardened film buffs or wealthy consumers could be bothered with these Super 8 reels. In the 1970s, home video took a massive leap with the arrival of analog video cassettes. This technology allowed consumers to record home movies and television content onto magnetic tape for their personal use, and also offered studios a way of introducing their films into homes. Unlike the limited runtime of Super 8, a full feature could be accommodated on one or more video cassettes without heavily compromising the viewing experience. The very first VHS release of a feature film came from South Korea, with the 1976 release of the 1972 film The Young Teacher. Among the first feature films released on VHS in the United States were classics such as The Sound of Music, Patton, and MASH. The first VCR units for the VHS format were made commercially available in Japan in 1976, but this came a year after the release of another magnetic tape format called Betamax, backed by Sony and launched in 1975. While the two formats would coexist until the discontinuation of Betamax in 2015, there was a long-running format war between the two. A number of studios, including Disney, watched with interest to see which of the two formats consumers would be drawn to, and sided with VHS when it became the clear winner. For many distributors, the idea that consumers would want to build their own personal collection of VHS titles wasn't taken into consideration. It was assumed they would be more inclined to rent titles, so prices for an individual VHS were set as high as $79.95, a price only appealing to rental stores. By the 1980s, this thinking had started to shift, and as VCR units became more affordable, the home video market began to shift from rental to ownership. This boom in the home video format happened to coincide with the rise of Hollywood blockbusters. Films like Star Wars, Jaws, and Raiders of the Lost Ark became VHS staples, and with the rush to replicate the success of Star Wars in the 1980s, imitators that failed at the box office could find new life on home video. Many of the studios were quick to take part in the growing popularity of home video, but one studio was conspicuously absent from the market: Disney. Home video was a whole new world for Hollywood, and while others were more willing to take the plunge, Disney would approach it with far more caution and suspicion. By the middle of the Second World War, Walt Disney Productions were in serious trouble. Almost every feature film they had released in the 1940s had been a commercial failure, and the studio had been sequestered by the United States Army during the war as a military base, producing training films and propaganda films for essentially no profit whatsoever. The contracts from the Army were just covering their budget, but they knew that if they were going to emerge from the war with the studio intact, they needed to make money as soon as possible. They decided to turn to their biggest success, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. The film had earned a stunning $4.2 million on its initial release in the US alone in 1937 and 1938. But over the last 7 years, audiences hadn't had many opportunities to see the film again. Snow White returned to cinemas in the US on February 22, 1944, and was once again an enormous commercial and critical success, enough to momentarily give Walt Disney Productions the financial respite they needed. What Walt and his brother Roy realized with the first re-release of Snow White was that their films may have as much value in return engagements as they did in their first theatrical runs. The idea of re-releasing classic films wasn't new. Universal had already started a healthy business bringing their classic horror films such as Dracula and Frankenstein back to theaters on a regular basis. But Walt Disney Productions devised a more structured plan. They would return their films to cinemas every 7 to 10 years, accompanied by a major marketing campaign announcing the return of the beloved films. Not only would this provide a steady revenue stream, but help to build the prestige of these films as classics. This practice would continue on a regular basis right into the 1990s, with Snow White alone receiving 8 theatrical re-releases, and would also begin to establish a hierarchy within the animated features. During Walt's lifetime, a number of films he saw as inferior, such as Alice in Wonderland and Sleeping Beauty, never returned to cinemas, and it was only after his death that they began to reappear and build a strong following. The package films of the 1940s were essentially dismantled for parts, not seen in their original form until well into the home video era. It's important to remember that until the late 1980s, a Disney animated feature could take up to 4 years to make, and no two productions would ever be in active production at the same time. This re-release schedule provided a dependable, steady income for the studio, especially with prestige titles like Snow White and Cinderella, who always brought an audience. This practice of bringing a film back to cinemas for a limited time and then returning it to moratorium was the beginning of what became known as the Disney Vault, a marketing tool the studio would deploy as they entered the home video market. We now understand the financial advantages of such an approach, but to begin with, the idea of restricting access to these films was as much about prestige as it was about protecting a steady income stream. Both of these considerations would come into play when the home video revolution began, and why Disney were reluctant to join. During the popularity of Super 8, Disney did release some of their cartoon shorts and a selection of highlight reels to the format, but this material was minor enough not to make an impact on the animated features. Their first formal step into the home video market began in 1978, when Disney partnered with the Music Corporation of America on their format, DiscoVision. A precursor for what was to become Laserdisc, the format placed film content onto large silver optical discs, similar to compact disc technology for music. Disney was dubious about the video cassette, especially the autonomy it gave consumers to record content onto the cassette from television. They had even joined Universal Pictures in a lawsuit against Sony over Betamax in 1976, claiming the format was copyright infringement. DiscoVision seemed a much safer option for their products, and their support for the format might sway consumers away from VHS and Betamax. 6 titles were released on DiscoVision, but only one, the 1960 film Kidnapped, was of feature length. The others were collections of shorts centered around different characters, including Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, and Chip and Dale. The format didn't prove popular or intuitive, so the deal with MCA expired in December 1981. It was at this point that Disney decided to establish their own home video division within the Walt Disney Telecommunications and Non-Theatrical Company. They struck a deal with Photomat, a drive-through photo development chain, for 13 rental titles to be available from their kiosks for between $7.95 and $13.95 a rental. Of those initial 13 titles, later expanded to 14, none were Disney animated features. They consisted almost entirely of live-action films, including high-profile titles such as Mary Poppins, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and Pete's Dragon, along with the cartoon compilations originally released on DiscoVision. All of these titles were available by the end of 1980 under the banner of Walt Disney Home Video. While most studios were reluctant to support the rental market, Disney made it their priority, even issuing different color cases for rental and commercial copies to ensure rental stores weren't violating their dealer agreements. Disney continued to release VHS titles through the early 1980s, but it was noted by industry and consumers that the animated films were conspicuously absent. While they were happy to release the many live-action films from their catalogue, and films like Mary Poppins were certainly no slouch, the animated films were their most prestigious titles, and there were concerns that release on the home video market might impact their theatrical re-release prospects. These films had gained enormous prestige with their limited accessibility, and a VHS was a permanent object that could be revisited whenever the consumer wanted, rather than the studio. As the market for home video began to grow, it soon became clear that Disney were going to need to release these films on VHS, Betamax, and the other home video formats sooner or later. On June 28, 1981, Walt Disney Home Video finally released Dumbo on VHS, the first of the animated films on home video. It was a smart tactical move on Disney's part. The film was beloved by audiences, but had also become a television staple in a cut-down version on The Wonderful World of Disney. Releasing the film on home video wouldn't impact its theatrical re-release potential. This was also true of the titles that followed it, The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, released at the same time, and Alice in Wonderland, released in October. The following year, Fun and Fancy Free was also released, with the marketing emphasising the Mickey and the Beanstalk section. While these titles might have been the safe option, Disney was still careful, only allowing them for release as rentals. Both Dumbo and Alice in Wonderland would be available for sale the following year, but for the next few years, these were the only titles available, and hardly the prestige titles the public were hoping for. When Ron Miller assumed the role of president and CEO of Walt Disney Productions in 1984, he set a series of initiatives into motion that would shape Disney for the decades to come. Chief among them would be the establishment of Touchstone Films and the Disney Channel, but Miller was also determined to take full advantage of the home video market.
The Disney Classics, the ultimate treasury of Disney magic. Featuring some of the most exclusive, most requested, and most recognized titles ever created by Hollywood.
There had been internal discussions in 1983 over what titles, if any, they should release, not just on home video, but on the Disney Channel. It was decided that the perfect candidate would be Robin Hood. It was a well-loved title, but not as beloved as many of the other films.
And now, a landmark decision has just been made by Walt Disney Productions to enable you to share some of this incredible magic with your customers. It's an unprecedented event in the history of the home video industry, one that's going to cause tremendous excitement all over the country. Introducing Walt Disney Home Video's first release in the Classics line, Robin Hood.
Gee whiz, it's Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, he says, wowee.
Now a whole new generation of children and their parents can experience the splendor of this timeless classic right in their own home, just in time for Christmas. Robin Hood, a stunning achievement in the art of animation, with a classic story loved by millions.
It was released on home video on December 3rd, 1984, the first title officially released under the banner of Walt Disney Classics, with the VHS cassette priced at $79.95 and the Laserdisc version at $34.95. This price difference is startling, but made sense to Disney at the time. They were still keen to push titles through the rental market, and while Laserdisc was the more expensive technology for the consumer, there were already concerns around how easy it would be for consumers to replicate a VHS. Disney would still, to a certain degree, have control over the title.
You'll roar with laughter. You'll squeal with delight. Oh. You'll stand up on your hind legs and cheer.
Bravo, Percy!
When one of the world's best love legends lives again. On video cassette, on video disc, Walt Disney Productions' Robin Hood.
Through these discussions, it was also determined what titles would not be made available on home video or the Disney Channel. In consultation with the Disney family, a list of films was drawn up, films that would not, under any circumstances, be made available to the public in any form other than theatrical re-release. These titles, which became known as the Untouchables, were Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, Pinocchio, Fantasia, Bambi, Cinderella, Peter Pan, Lady and the Tramp, Sleeping Beauty, 101 Dalmatians, The Sword and the Stone, The Jungle Book, The Aristocats, The Rescuers, and The Fox and the Hound. None of these films had ever been shown on television and had all made money on their theatrical re-releases. For the foreseeable future, they would remain under complete control of Walt Disney Productions. By the time Miller resigned from Walt Disney Productions in 1985, only Robin Hood had been released. As was the case with many of Miller's initiatives, the new administration at Disney under Michael Eisner and Frank Wells would benefit from the initial work he had spearheaded with the home video market. Finally, bringing Disney to the forefront of the market, though, would require even more careful negotiations. On December 21st, 1984, Pinocchio was released in US cinemas, its first re-release since 1978. With each subsequent return to cinemas, the film had continued to grow in acclaim and box office. And in its 1984-1985 run, the film made $26.9 million in the US and Canada, a comparable amount to The Black Cauldron released the same year. Unlike Cauldron, though, this was profit made on a 45-year-old film, a fact that did not go unnoticed to Michael Eisner. Among the team who moved with Eisner from Paramount to Disney was Bill Mechanic, who had worked as a senior creative executive for Paramount Pictures. He was handed to Jeffrey Katzenberg, who placed him in charge of the home video division. As well as Walt Disney home video titles, there was also Buena Vista Home Video, established in 1984 to distribute content separate from Disney, including VHS releases of The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle and Alvin and the Chipmunks. This appointment wasn't exactly what Mechanic had wanted. By 1984, the home video market still hadn't taken off, and video cassettes were still too expensive to be popular with consumers. With the success of Pinocchio in re-release, Eisner and Wells suggested that the film should be a candidate for release on home video. Both Roy Disney and Katzenberg objected to the idea. Releasing Robin Hood posed little risk to the prestige of Disney animation, but while Pinocchio wasn't yet regarded as one of the crown jewels of the art form, there was a certain amount of respect for the film within the company. Bill Mechanic, by contrast, became a strong advocate for the idea. He thought it possible that by shifting public perception away from rentals, home video releases of Disney animated classics could become collector's items, maybe even family heirlooms. Reframing the releases as such might help justify their cost to consumers. Eisner thought this was a silly idea. A compromise was finally reached. Pinocchio would be released on VHS, Betamax, and Laserdisc, but the VHS would be priced at $79.95, a cost only appealing to rental stores. They would also introduce another caveat, one that would maintain their control of the title and would become integral to Disney's home video strategy. Pinocchio would only be available for a limited time, after which all copies would be removed from shelves, essentially replicating the moratorium practice used for the theatrical releases.
Thanks to you, the premier classics release, Robin Hood, became one of the 15 best-selling video titles ever.
They just saw Robin Hood, you know, and they loved that.
And now, we're proud to announce the release of the second feature in the Disney Classics line.
Well, I saw it as a child, and when my children grew up, I took them to see it.
I remember the kids just really loved it and begged for us to take them back to see it again.
It's a beautiful production, and I'd love to see it again and again and again.
I saw it a lot of times.
It's just a great film to watch and enjoy.
The animation, I think, was great.
I loved the music.
It's a classic film.
It definitely is.
Fresh from its $26 million theatrical run comes Christmas 1984's second biggest box office hit. It's the long-awaited release on video of the crown jewel of Disney animation art, Pinocchio.
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 Pinocchio!
Pinocchio made its home video debut on July 16, 1985. A publicity campaign costing $1 million was launched to support the release, including one of the first television advertising campaigns for a single VHS release. Despite the high cost, sales were surprisingly consistent, with around 150,000 units sold, and audiences certainly seemed enthusiastic about having access to the film for home viewing. Mechanic still had faith in his idea of the film as a collectible, and in August 1985 began exploring options to make the film even more appealing to consumers. He decided to drop the price down to $29.95, along with a second advertising campaign to promote the release. An extra $7 million was spent in advertising, an amount that horrified Katzenberg. He reprimanded Mechanic for spending so much on a pre-sold property, but Mechanic pushed back. The only way they were going to change the consumer relationship with home video was to shift their perception of it, and this was their opportunity to do so. On November 5th, Pinocchio, Robin Hood, and Dumbo became available for $29.95. Almost immediately, sales skyrocketed. Very soon, Pinocchio sold out its 1.7 million unit run and became the biggest selling VHS title of the year. Mechanic's hunch had proven correct. More than renting the films, consumers were keen to have the Disney animated films as permanent fixtures in their homes. On April 30, 1987, both Pinocchio and Robin Hood went into moratorium, while Dumbo remained on sale. The next title to enter the Walt Disney Classics line was The Sword in the Stone. While it had initially been counted among the untouchable titles, its status changed after it aired on television in 1985. The film arrived on VHS on March 25, 1986, though once again at the $79.95 price. 2 months later, in May, Alice in Wonderland was made available once again as a commercial title and has been publicly available on home video ever since. Bill Mechanic was now keen to follow up the success of Pinocchio with another major classic, and the obvious candidate was Cinderella. It was due for a theatrical run in the next 2 years, and it was even more beloved than Pinocchio. It was for this reason that Katzenberg and Roy Disney resisted the idea. In the hierarchy of Disney classics, Cinderella was almost comparable to Snow White, and had the added emotional weight of being the film that saved the studio at the start of the 1950s. Frustrated, Mechanic went to Eisner and Wells to argue his case. A meeting was called to discuss the issue, with Eisner, Wells, Katzenberg, and other executives present. Mechanic made his case for the title, examining the emotional issues and the financial issues. For both he and Eisner, the emotional issues were a moot point, factors that were too unknowable to be taken into consideration. But Mechanic argued that while the film could make $25 million per theatrical run, a cumulative box office of $125 million over 28 years, a single VHS release at $29.98 could make over $100 million in a single year. Eisner and Wells were convinced, but Roy wouldn't budge on Cinderella. Once again, a compromise was reached. Instead of Cinderella, they would release Sleeping Beauty, a far less revered film that had never performed well at the box office and had seen far fewer re-releases. It would have a theatrical release in March 1986 and be followed with a VHS release in October. Bill Mechanic decided to make the film the centerpiece of a new $6 million advertising campaign, Bring Disney Home for Good. At this stage, all five of the previous titles were still in print, so Sleeping Beauty could be promoted as the sixth title in the series. This began Disney's tactic of encouraging consumers to build their own Disney VHS library, sweetened by the $29.95 price tag for all six films.
You are about to see Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty as you have never seen it before. Because, for the very first time, this masterpiece of adventure and romance will not appear in a theater, but in your very own home on videocassette. Now, you and your family can own Sleeping Beauty forever for only $29.95. Now you can bring Disney home for good.
This campaign would also have an enormous impact on the public perception of Sleeping Beauty itself. Disney had never thought of it as one of their prestige titles, but the VHS campaign promoted the film as one of their crowning achievements, the classic you've been waiting for. During its theatrical run in 1986, the film had only made $15 million at the domestic box office. On VHS, it would sell 3 million copies and become the biggest-selling VHS title of 1986, returning to moratorium in March 1988. With the enormous success of the release, Sleeping Beauty had transformed from an empty bauble to one of the great works of the Disney canon. After the success of Sleeping Beauty in 1986, and even greater success with the VHS release of Lady and the Tramp in October 1987, where it became the biggest-selling VHS of all time, Katzenberg and Roy finally agreed to release Cinderella on home video. The success of the films on the format was undeniable, and with the theatrical run set for November 1987, there was nothing to suggest the release wouldn't be even more successful than the previous titles.
For a limited time, the story no child should be without. Walt Disney's Cinderella on videocassette.
Uh-oh, I think we waited too long. The last one looks like it's gone.
Their prediction was correct. Cinderella exceeded the sales of Lady and the Tramp, selling 7.2 million copies and generating over $100 million in revenue. By this point, Walt Disney Home Video had become a staple of family collections and Christmas presents, and a whole new generation were discovering these films, not just in theaters, but once again, at home. Cinderella was also the first title announced beforehand as a limited release. During its advertising campaign, Disney announced that the film would only be available until April 1989, the shortest release window so far. Consumers would only have 6 months to purchase the film before it would disappear from shelves, for who knew how long. By this point, Sleeping Beauty, Pinocchio, and Lady and the Tramp had already been placed in moratorium, and in September 1989, the release of Bambi would come with a similar warning.
Don't you wish you bought Pinocchio when you had the chance? Wouldn't you love to have Lady and the Tramp in your collection? Now they're gone. And time's running out for Cinderella, too. But you still have a chance to own Disney's most celebrated animated masterpiece. It's Bambi. Still available, but for a very limited time. Don't let Bambi get away.
While Roy and Katzenberg were willing to relax their objections with Cinderella, there were two titles on which they stood firm. They would not allow a home video release of either Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or Fantasia. If Cinderella was a prestige title, these two films were the apex, the two projects closest to Walt's heart. No amount of revenue was worth tarnishing their reputation. A month after the VHS release of Cinderella, Disney theatrically released their latest animated film, Oliver and Company, the first since the Walt Disney Classics line had become a major force in their home entertainment strategy. While Disney continued to release classic animated films on VHS with Bambi in 1989, they showed no signs of releasing Oliver or the previous film, The Great Mouse Detective. Releasing a classic was one thing, but they had no strategy for their more recent films. Much of the planning and promotion around the Walt Disney Classics titles had been dictated by the studio's 7 to 10 year re-release schedule, with all of these titles now generating mostly profit. It was unclear how a VHS title of a more recent film would affect its future re-release prospects, or even when such titles should appear on home video. As would be the case across the entirety of the Walt Disney Company, the blockbuster release of The Little Mermaid would dramatically shift the practices of Walt Disney Home Video. The film was a critical and commercial success on a scale Walt Disney Animation Studios had practically never seen, and it became clear that a home video release was not just inevitable, but a financial necessity.
Now you can bring home the most successful animated motion picture of all time. The winner of 2 Academy Awards, Walt Disney's The Little Mermaid is yours to own on video cassette. Under the sea. Now the magic, the music, the wonder, and the excitement can all be enjoyed again and again.
This is wonderful.
This is The Little Mermaid on video cassette. Only $23.99 with mail-in refund. Make The Little Mermaid part of your world.
On May 18, 1990, 6 months after its theatrical premiere, The Little Mermaid was released on home video. It was a shocking, unprecedented decision. No film of this scale had ever been released on VHS, while the film itself was still in theatres. The release was even promoted in the film's print cinema advertising. It was also advertised as part of the Walt Disney Classics line, a bold move since all of the previous films were decades old and acknowledged classics, while The Little Mermaid, though highly acclaimed, was hardly old enough to be considered as such. This began Disney's practice of labelling all their films in this way, first as a classic, and later in the 90s as a masterpiece, terms they would use so freely that they began to hold little meaning. This was all part of shifting the narrative around the Disney animated films. If they were proclaiming films as recent as The Little Mermaid as a classic comparable to Cinderella, this guaranteed its status as a prestige film from the beginning, and helped plant the new Disney animated features within the wider legacy of Disney animation. In its first month alone, The Little Mermaid sold 7 million copies. By the time it went into moratorium, it had sold 10 million copies and made over $180 million, making it the best-selling VHS title of the year. What is even more extraordinary about those numbers, as well as the fact that the film was still in theaters, was that The Little Mermaid, like Cinderella, was only made available for 6 months. Once again, Disney were training their consumers to buy these titles as fast as possible, and as many as possible before they would disappear. As a result, secondhand copies of titles like The Little Mermaid would sell for hundreds of dollars, and collectors who missed out were forced to track down copies at enormously inflated prices. As Walt Disney Animation Studios moved from strength to strength, from the overwhelming critical acclaim of Beauty and the Beast to the stellar box office success of Aladdin, this process of offering limited home video releases for their recent films became standard practice, with each new Walt Disney classic selling in higher and higher numbers. In 1995, the staggering box office success of The Lion King was followed by a record-breaking VHS release. To date, The Lion King is the biggest-selling VHS title of all time, having sold 32 million copies and generating over $500 million in revenue. In the meantime, Walt Disney Classics enjoyed further success with the release of both Peter Pan and The Jungle Book, paired with theatrical runs and selling well to consumers. The price for the titles began to drop, with The Jungle Book selling at $24.99, and both titles returning to moratorium within a year. Despite this, Roy held firm on protecting Snow White and Fantasia. The latter in particular was an important part of his family's legacy, and over the last 50 years, its reputation had slowly begun to build. While he wasn't interested in the home video release, he was keen to pick up where Walt had left off. When Eisner had joined the company in 1985, Roy expressed his desire to create a sequel to Fantasia, to realize Walt's dream of the film being a perpetual work in progress, with new sequences added periodically. Eisner wasn't adverse to the idea, even discussing it with legendary composer Leonard Bernstein, but Jeffrey Katzenberg was staunchly against it. Fantasia may have had artistic or sentimental value within the company, but it had been one of the studio's biggest financial failures. And if audiences hadn't been taken by the marriage of classical music and mostly abstract animation in 1940, they certainly wouldn't be in the 1990s. And yet, Fantasia was one of the most requested VHS titles. It would need to be released at some point, and with public interest in the films on VHS growing each year, this seemed as good a time as any. Eisner came up with a compromise. Fantasia would soon be celebrating its 50th anniversary, with the film set to return to theaters in October 1990 for a limited engagement following a massive restoration effort to return the film as close as possible to its original length. Eisner proposed that this theatrical release be followed by a home video release, and all profit from that release would finance Roy's plans for a Fantasia sequel. After consulting with the Disney family, Roy agreed. For the home video release of Fantasia, the marketing department went into overdrive. The release was billed as a major event, with lavish VHS and Laserdisc gift sets, including lithographs, the newly restored soundtrack, and a making-of documentary. The marketing was sparse and classical, dominated by the iconic image of Mickey in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. The text on the poster and the units themselves proclaimed it Walt Disney's masterpiece. There wasn't an element of the release that wasn't scrutinized and perfected. In many ways, the finest home video campaign in Disney's history.
Now on video for a limited time.
Hey, I can't believe what I got you, Jake. Look, it's Fantasia. It's just for you. Well, all right, maybe not just for you. I mean, I gotta tell you, it's magic.
That's right. Mickey, yeah.
Between you and me, this was our only chance to get it, and I didn't want you to miss it.
Walt Disney's masterpiece, Fantasia. It's the perfect holiday gift.
Well, of course I got it for you. I'm your dad. Fantasia is ours forever.
The release was set for November 1st, 1991 on VHS, Laserdisc, and Betamax, and would be the first title released simultaneously at the same time around the world. Where previous titles had been on shelves for 6 to 12 months, Fantasia would only be available to purchase in the US for 50 days. For international markets, this window was extended to 100 days. Once this window was closed, Fantasia would return to moratorium, but Disney were not being coy about its future. It was billed as the final release of the original masterpiece, available for the first and last time in its original form. The message was clear. This was the one chance consumers had to own Fantasia for the foreseeable future, after which it would be locked away, possibly, or so they implied, for good. By the end of its 50-day window in the US, Fantasia sold 14.2 million copies. Before it had even been released, there were over 9 million advanced orders for the VHS copies alone. The interest on Fantasia is higher than any other title we've ever carried, including Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, said a home video retailer to the Chicago Tribune in October 1991. But there's an extra factor at work here. Fantasia carries the Disney name, which means it's highly collectible. There will be hundreds of people out there buying the tape or disc who may never play it, but will put it on the closet shelf and hope that years from now it'll be worth a lot of money. The enormous success of Fantasia on home video did indeed allow Roy Disney to begin development on a sequel, but it would also change the fortunes of the original film. Fantasia had now moved from a curiosity to a titan in cinema history, a film of such importance that it almost existed outside of the traditional Disney classics. After the film returned to moratorium, Michael Eisner called Lillian Disney, Walt's widow. He had some exciting news to share with her. Fantasia had been a colossal financial failure for Walt Disney Productions in 1940, enough that the future of the studio had been placed in jeopardy. Eisner was pleased to tell Lillian that half a century later, with the home video release, Fantasia had finally turned a profit. Throughout the early 1990s, most of the great Disney animated films made the move to home video, often paired with a theatrical re-release. Films like 101 Dalmatians and The Fox and the Hound became available, leaving very few of the untouchable films untouched, while Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin were inducted into the Walt Disney Classics line. With The Fox and the Hound in March 1994, that line of titles officially came to an end. There was still one title, though, that continued to remain locked away: Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. Nearly a decade after Roy and Katzenberg had refused to allow the film to be released on home video, it was finally decided that the time had come to make it available to the public. In 1993, the film became the first to receive a major digital restoration, with each frame scanned at 4K resolution and digitally restored. This new restoration was released in theatres in July 1993, and a home video release was set for the following year. As well as completing unfinished business for Walt Disney Home Video, the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves presented them with a tantalising opportunity. The film was used as the launch of a new line, the Walt Disney Masterpiece Collection. Many of their prestige titles had now been in moratorium for nearly a decade, and the traditional schedule meant that they were due to be released once again. By the mid-90s, Disney's reluctance with home video had changed dramatically. VHS had become a massive industry, both for everyday consumers and collectors, and the company started to see greater financial prospects for these titles on home video rather than theatrical release. They had also begun to note a flaw in the magnetic tape technology. Unlike Laserdisc and compact discs, VHS, Betamax, and cassette tapes degrade over time, and especially with excessive use. Children often talked about watching these VHS copies hundreds of times. Copies of Pinocchio bought in the mid-1980s were now so badly worn that they became unwatchable, and consumers were desperate to replace their old tapes. In many cases, they turned to the second-hand market. Disney much preferred the idea of that money going into their pocket.
But it was fascinating.
I hope.
I've never seen anything like that before.
There are certain scenes that stay in your mind.
The first image of the queen.
Mirror on the wall.
I like when you know who's good and you know who's evil.
Being a father now and watching it through your son's eyes.
Isn't it?
That love never fails.
He just kissed her and she woke up and we said, yay!
Walt Disney's classic masterpiece, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, on video for the first time.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs hit shelves on VHS and Laserdisc on October 28, 1994, and in its 6 months of release, sold 24 million copies and earned nearly $500 million. On the same day, Disney also released 9 other titles to the Walt Disney Masterpiece Collection. Some of them, like Alice in Wonderland and Dumbo, were titles that had never been out of print, while others, like The Sword in the Stone and The Three Caballeros, were returning or debuting on the format. They also included many of their biggest live-action films, including Mary Poppins, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, So Dear to My Heart, and Pete's Dragon. The Masterpiece line would see the debut of a number of films to home video, including Oliver and Company and The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, along with the returning titles such as Bambi and The Jungle Book, and the induction of all new films such as The Lion King, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and Mulan. As had been the case with the Classics line, the term masterpiece was used freely, assigned to every title, whether it was a new film or one arguably undeserving of the accolade, such as Melody Time or The Black Cauldron. The line would reach its peak when in 1998, they finally re-released The Little Mermaid to record-breaking sales. While many titles would remain on sale permanently, a selection of films would once again be returned to moratorium after a period of time, establishing a prestige series of titles. By this time, the term the Disney Vault had become vernacular, a shorthand used by the studio in advertising campaigns to urge customers to buy these titles as quickly as possible.
A special announcement from Walt Disney Home Video. For those of you who haven't bought The Lion King and Cinderella on video, Disney will stop selling these classics in just a few weeks.
Good heavens!
This is your last chance to buy these two great Disney videos.
Time out! Let me get this straight.
You may never be able to buy them again.
And you never told us?
Buy the Disney classic videos Cinderella and The Lion King while you still can. Because once they're gone, they're gone.
Run, Pumbaa! Move it!
14 films were included in the vault, with 13 released at regular intervals during the DVD era, and Fantasia reserved for one-off releases on each new format. By the end of the 90s, VHS had dominated the video market for over a decade. Betamax had all but disappeared, and Laserdisc was reserved for enthusiasts. In 1997, a new optical disc technology entered the market. Dubbed Digital Versatile Discs, or DVD, it offered a better video and audio quality and greater consumer interaction, but like any new technology, was too expensive for the everyday household. By the end of the 90s, the format had begun to pick up steam, and soon into the 2000s, began to pummel VHS in sales. The world of home entertainment was about to shift from magnetic to digital.
I think it brought me back to my childhood, watching it getting all excited again about the scary parts and watching her get excited.
It brought me totally back to my childhood. I hadn't seen it since I was a little girl.
When I'm with them, I'm as young as they are, and I'm watching a Disney film. I become an 8 and a 9 year old again.
Not that many movies can withstand that
Go
many generations.
Generations like that.
Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty, the one classic you don't own, is now on video while supplies last.
Just as Bill Mechanic had predicted, VHS copies of Disney animated films had become beloved household items. Families and collectors proudly displayed their titles in their homes, each release a carefully curated, aesthetically pleasing object, with striking cover art and matching designs. They also had prestige as rare objects, children using ownership of a title as cultural cachet in the playground or at school. Home video had become one of the biggest revenue streams for Disney, helping to establish them as a great cultural and entertainment juggernaut at the end of the 20th century. Of the top 10 best-selling VHS titles of all time, 6 of them are Disney animated features. As the new century emerged and the popularity of DVD began to grow, it became clear that much like vinyl and cassette in the wake of compact discs, the days of VHS may be coming to an end. In order to keep up, Walt Disney Home Entertainment would need to contend with a whole new home entertainment format. The reign of the DVD was about to begin. Thanks for listening to our in-betweener on the history of Walt Disney Home Video. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about its development, including cover art and advertisements from the major releases discussed in this episode. You can follow Ink and Paint on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at InkPaintPod for bonus material and news on upcoming episodes. You can also email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. A big thank you to all our listeners supporting us on Patreon. If you'd like to support the podcast and have access to exclusive bonus content, be sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/inkpaintpod. We'll be releasing new in-betweeners as we go along, so make sure you subscribe to Ink and Paint to make sure you don't miss any. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to rate and review and to tell your friends about us. Ink and Paint in-betweeners are created, hosted and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Theme music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Piranakis, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.